It's nice to see each one of you. Thank you for coming. I'd like to begin so we don't squander any moments we have around this matter. This is the last... Are they getting the sound? This is the last Running Center event for this term. So it's nice that we can begin with the new dean of Augustana, Dean Berger. Dean Berger comes to us from Maine, which is one of those wonderful places in the United States of America where they have real Yankees. I had a friend back in the 60s who decided he was going to simplify his life. He had a wonderful philosophical and theological mind, and he'd become disillusioned with America, disillusioned with the modern world, probably disillusioned with himself. So to simplify his life, he got a little piece of land in Maine and the Whole Earth catalog and books about building log houses and beekeeping. And after about 4 years, in a state of utter exhaustion, he said to me, "It is far, far too difficult and too expensive to simplify your life." So I don't really know the reason why Dean Berger has come to Camrose, but I assume it's to make his life more complex. So in any case, we're delighted to have you. Dean Berger is an anthropologist and spent some time, I know, like many anthropologists, I don't know how many of you are aware of it, but most anthropologists, of course, choose their field of study based on the difficulty of the climate. You know, they want to study things that are really difficult, so he went to Sardinia, where nobody would ever want to spend time, I think. In any case, he's been with us now since the summer, and we're delighted you're here, and delighted that you have brought your life's companion here as well, and that we'll get a chance to know you and hear you sometime, I trust, as well, on the things that interest you. So welcome, and the theme for today is a reflection on a very famous song by the Beatles, as you may know, a song about Gideon and his Bible in hotel rooms. But I think we've shifted it to school rooms. So it's an issue that, at least the principles of which, are at the center of so many issues of religion and public life and bubble in the newspapers every day. So I'm looking forward to hearing you on this, engaging you.
Yeah, thank you very much, David. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to be speaking to all of you today, not as an anthropologist, not as an academic, simply as a citizen who got caught up in an interesting story back in the United States. David introduced my wife, Becky, who's back there. She's here. She promised to keep me honest. I'm going to divide my remarks into four sections. First, talk a little bit autobiographically, tell you a bit about me and my family. Then delve briefly into some matters related to American constitutional law, particularly the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment to the American Constitution. Then bring it into a Canadian context, and wrap up with some questions for us to discuss together. So that's the agenda. Autobiography, spinning quickly through my life. I grew up in New Jersey in a Reform Jewish family. I went off to college in Chicago, and I met a girl who grew up in a rural fundamentalist Christian church. And we fell in love, and we got married. the challenges of planning a wedding to please both of our families is a topic for another presentation. So one of the first things that Becky and I faced was the decision about how to raise our children, particularly with regard to the role that religion would play in their lives and in our lives together. And basically what we decided is that we would expose them to the faith traditions of both of our families, and with a great deal of confidence we felt they would eventually work it out themselves. That's a subject for another talk. We settled in rural Indiana, not far from the family farm where Becky grew up, and I was working as a professor of anthropology at the local Catholic college. Becky was working as a kindergarten teacher in the local public schools. The area of Indiana where we lived might be described as the heart of the American Bible Belt. Becky and I developed an affiliation, mine arm's length, hers official membership with the local Presbyterian Church, as this seemed to be the only progressive, if you will, Christian option in town, with a dynamic husband and wife minister pair who we both developed a liking for. I occasionally was the only Jewish Sunday school teacher at the Presbyterian Church.
You and Jesus. Jesus was teaching.
That's true. And in fact, at on one occasion when they wanted a photo of all of the members of the church for the annual calendar, I, as the local hanger-on, was asked to take the photo, and instead of asking them all to say cheese, I said, on three, I want you all to say Jesus was Jewish. They all laughed. And I snapped the picture. In the fall of 1989, at a church breakfast at that Presbyterian church, I got into a conversation with one of my former students who had become a school teacher in one of the local schools. And she told me a story about the Gideon's International coming into the school, into her school, to distribute Gideon Bibles. She wasn't a constitutional lawyer, but she just felt instinctively there was something wrong with this. She worked in a neighboring town, so I inquired if, in fact, this happened in our own town, and discovered not only that it did happen, but that a Bible distribution occurred every year with the Gideons gaining permission from school authorities to distribute Bibles to fifth grade students. Well, it so happened we had a fifth grade student, our son Joshua. So I decided to try to preempt this event and wrote a letter to the school board and to the superintendent in which I pointed out the reasons why I thought this was inappropriate and, in fact, contrary to the United States Constitution, and was hopeful that I would receive a reply. Why was I upset? Well, I was upset, first of all, because it seemed very clear to me that the purpose of the Bible distribution was not to educate students about comparative religion, or was even to educate students about religion in any way, shape, or form. The purpose was simply to proselytize. The proselytizing intent later became even clearer to me when I learned that the Bibles that the students received included inside the front cover the following invitation. confessing to God that I am a sinner and believing that the Lord Jesus Christ died for my sins on the cross and was raised for my justification, I do now receive and confess him as my personal Savior. And the fifth grade student, what are fifth graders? Let's see. Maybe 10 years old, 11, were invited to sign and date that statement. To me, this appeared to be an attempt to use the coercive powers of government to advance a particular religion. In this instance, the coercive powers of government being mandatory attendance at public school and mandatory convocation in the gymnasium where these Bibles were handed out. I told you I had hoped to receive a reply to my complaint. I went off to an anthropology conference in Washington, D.C. When I got home, my wife asked if I had seen the local paper. I had not, of course. She showed it to me. Banner headline in the local paper said, "Local parent wishes to ban the Bible." As I learned more, I discovered that the Bible distribution was not an isolated practice. An organization called the In Jesus' Love Foundation was also occasionally invited to distribute literature in the schools. Christian hymns were sung routinely at school concerts for the holidays, but also at other times. Christian prayers were recited at football games, etc. You get the picture. So I contacted the Indiana Civil Liberties Union, which is an arm of the American Civil Liberties Union, and they decided to represent our family in a lawsuit. Our two children, Joshua and Mariah, Joshua was in the fifth grade at the time, Mariah the first grade, were the plaintiffs, and by legal parlance, I was what's called their next friend. Becky wasn't involved directly, but she bore most of the brunt because she was employed by the people we were suing. What was the community's response? Well, I can quote to you from a few things that appeared in the newspaper at the time. A local reporter wrote, "Technically, the bottom line is what the Gideons have done for years and what the public schools have allowed is, in fact, a violation of the U.S. Constitution. Technically, that is. Like, nobody has ever jaywalked or driven without their seatbelt." In a letter to the editor, a local citizen wrote, "Mr. Berger's fear of Christianity doesn't seem to be a problem where he works or when it's time to pick up his paycheck." And another letter to the editor, "Did you know that the Bible and prayer have left, that since the Bible and prayer have left our public schools, we went from problems such as chewing gum and talking in class to students concealing weapons, murder and drugs in such a short time. We have mothers killing their babies, sons stabbing their mothers, and fathers shooting their sons. We have pornography and prostitution, abduction and molestation. We fear to leave our homes unlocked or allow our children to play unattended." Clearly what I was doing was dangerous. It was alleged.
Can I just interrupt this? That the person is saying there's three large PR copies and she felt bad to interrupt. And I do too. Right?
Three large copies and a tea. Who else? They belong to somebody. There were allegations that I was part of, quote, a Jesuit's conspiracy against the King James Bible. Many assumed I was Catholic since I worked at a Catholic college. And there were concerns that I was aligned with what was labeled a counterfeit church and a satanic system. The school board organized a school board meeting that was moved to a large school auditorium to discuss my letter of complaint. There were literally a few hundred people who showed up. Apart from a few personal friends, and the minister of this Presbyterian church who sat with me, I didn't have an ally in the room. And till this day, I've never seen a profile in courage as I experienced that evening with that local minister. At the school board meeting, various people alleged that the separation of church and state was nowhere mentioned in the United States Constitution. In fact, it was only mentioned in the Constitution of the USSR. One parent quoted George Washington, who is alleged to have said, "No man can consider himself truly educated who does not possess a thorough working knowledge of the Bible." Many claim that one person shouldn't be able to dictate the rights of the majority, allege that I was engaged in censorship, an advocate for the bogeyman called secular humanism, etc. Our lawsuit extended over 4 years. It took a major chunk out of our lives. We had a lot of public notoriety, as I explained. That notoriety went national when the New York Times featured us in a full-page story in one of its Sunday editions. Once that newspaper came out, we were receiving calls from every media outlet in the United States. All of the major religious organizations aligned themselves on one side or the other of our lawsuit. So and they filed what are called friend of the court briefs. On our side, we had organizations like the National Council of Churches, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, the American Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Committee. On their side, they had organizations like the Moral Majority, the Rutherford Institute, and the National Legal Foundation. The reason it took 4 years to wind its way through the courts is because we lost in the first round in federal district court on a ruling by a conservative Reagan-appointed Republican jurist. We appealed that ruling to the federal appeals court in Chicago and won that decision on a 3-0 vote of the judicial panel. The school board then appealed that decision and asked for an en banc hearing, which involves all the justices of the appellate court. And when they didn't get satisfaction, they appealed the ruling to the United States Supreme Court. The Supreme Court simply let the appellate court ruling stand, and that was the end of the lawsuit. The denouement that came a few months later was when we collected legal fees. The Indiana Civil Liberties Union had worked for us on a pro bono basis, but had kept track of all the time that they dedicated to this lawsuit, and we asked for the defendants, the school corporation, to pay legal fees. That amounted to a few $100,000. The community had to raise taxes to pay the legal bill, and that's when I started moving to new institutions and eventually ending my journey here in Camrose.
It's a sanctuary for you.
Yeah, that's right. So, American constitutional law is context. I don't pretend that raised in Canada, all of you have necessarily studied American constitutional law. Most Americans haven't either. There's an important document that's a part of the American Constitution called the Bill of Rights. It's the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, and the Bill of Rights mostly places limitations on government that are designed to protect the natural rights of liberty and property. The Bill of Rights was introduced by James Madison to the first United States Congress in 1789. Madison was influenced to a great extent by the philosophy of John Locke, and the Bill of Rights was ratified in 1791. Here's what we're concerned with today is the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. Here's what it says. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or permitting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. The First Amendment is arguably the foundation of American democracy in the rights that it gives to free citizens. Free speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly. In our case, we're concerned with the first two clauses. The Establishment Clause, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, and the Free Exercise Clause, or prohibit the free exercise of religion. These two clauses are grounded in three basic beliefs. First, a belief in religious freedom. The government should not interfere with private religious expression. Second, a belief in religious voluntarism. The advancement of a religious sect should come from the voluntary efforts of its members, not from governmental efforts. And third, a belief in the value of religion. Hence, it deserves protection. There's an important process that occurred in the United States during the 20th century called the incorporation of the Bill of Rights. And what this means is the American courts applied the Bill of Rights to the states and to local governments. Notice when I read the amendment initially, it said, Congress shall make no law. That's the National Congress. Prior to the 1890s, the Bill of Rights only applied to the federal government. But under the incorporation doctrine, most of the provisions of the Bill of Rights now apply to state and local governments. And that's by virtue of a very important amendment to the Constitution after the Civil War, the 14th Amendment, which not only gave citizenship rights to blacks, but also included something called the Due Process Clause. And the Due Process Clause prohibited state and local governments from depriving persons of life, liberty, property, etc., without due process. This was originally designed to protect African Americans and other minorities, but through the incorporation doctrine led to the application of the full Bill of Rights to the states and to municipalities for the purpose of protecting all citizens. In 1940, the first federal court decision appeared, which incorporated the Free Exercise Clause, and in 1947, the first court decision appeared, which incorporated the Establishment Clause. For our purposes in our lawsuit, we relied on a legal precedent from 1971 called Lemon versus Kurtzman. Lemon versus Kurtzman established what was called a three-pronged test for determining whether or not a governmental policy offended the Establishment Clause. And here's what that legal decision by the Supreme Court of the United States said. Well, it said, first of all, to be legal, a practice has to pass all three of these prongs. One, the government action or policy must have a secular legislative purpose. That was subsequently interpreted as asking the question, is the government's purpose in performing or permitting the act to endorse or disapprove of religion? So that's the purpose prong. The second prong is known as the effect prong, and that says the principal or primary effect of the government action must be one that neither advances nor inhibits religion, interpreted later as raising the question, is it sufficiently likely that a reasonable observer would perceive the act as an endorsement or a disapproval of their individual religious choices? And then the third prong is of Lemon v. Kurtzman, of the Lemon test. The government policy must not foster an excessive entanglement with religion. Our argument in our legal briefs was that the alliance between the schools and the Gideon's, the public school and the Gideon's International, failed all three prongs of the Lemon test. The school board's argument included a number of facts and legal interpretations. First of all, they pointed out that the Bible distribution was only done after parental permission slips were sent out. So one might ask the question, should that be sufficient to make this practice legal? Although in point of fact, the school board had not sent out permission slips for years. Second argument they made, the students could return the Bibles if their parents objected. Third argument, the Bibles were distributed by a private actor, a representative of the Gideons, not by a teacher or by a school administrator. Fourth argument, school policy regarding the distribution of any materials by outside groups in the schools was content neutral. It didn't specify who could come in and who couldn't. It just said you needed the permission of the principal or the whichever executive was in charge of the school building. And therefore, the policy was thoroughly secular and not religious. An additional argument was that to not allow the Gideons to distribute Bibles in the schools would be to discriminate against religion and to engage in censorship. The attorney for the school was quoted in the newspaper as saying, quote, "The government cannot prevent you from exercising your religion." Well, the Gideons are exercising their religion. They're not imposing it on anybody. They're not coercing anybody. In addition, it was alleged that what the school board had created was an open forum in the schools. After all, they allowed access to the 4-H organization, to the Boy Scouts, to the Girl Scouts. They allowed the Daughters of the American Revolution to sponsor an essay contest, etc. And that open forum constituted equal access for all community groups. To not allow the Gideons would be to discriminate against them on the basis of their religion. In taking depositions, of course, our attorney asked the school superintendent if she would allow, no other religious group had ever distributed their literature in the schools, if she would allow other religious groups to distribute their literature in the schools. Her response, and I quote, was, "Yes, but not Satanists or other religions like that." I'm not sure what constitutes other religions like that. Probably Judaism. It was also alleged that the school's involvement was merely incidental. It didn't rise to the level of excessive entanglement that Lemon required. And above all, that what Allenberger and his children were engaged in was interference with the free exercise of religion and particularly with the religious liberty of school children. So, that's our story. I find it particularly interesting that these same issues have arisen and gained a great deal of prominence right here in Alberta since our arrival a scant 4 months ago.
Do you have anything to do with that, actually?
No, I didn't.
You send somebody ahead?
I don't even know this guy in St. Albert. But this is a story from the Edmonton newspaper, recent story, St. Albert man fights prayer in public school. And let me let me first read to you the subtitle. St. Albert Man Fights Prayer in Public School, the subtitle, Why is Secular School Imposing Religion of the Cult, the Religion of the Cultural Majority on Non-Christian Atheists? Clearly, this reporter is not handling this in an even-handed manner. But, nonetheless, the facts in this case are an atheist parent who is objecting to the fact that in this school in St. Albert, every morning before the start of school, the students are led in saying the Lord's Prayer. Let me quote to you what the principal has to say about that and what the complaining parent has to say. The principal, Garnett Gertson, says, "The Lord's Prayer is part of opening exercises. It's been a part of this community's tradition since the school was founded. This community is predominantly a Christian community, and it has been ever since the school opened." Here's what the parent has to say. "This is a great school with some great people. I just think they don't understand that their privilege of historic dominance comes at the cost of other people's rights, or that what they were doing doesn't meet the charter's promise to my children. The school's policy is as follows. Quote, the board believes that our schools are responsible for helping children develop emotionally, intellectually, physically, morally, and spiritually. In accordance with the School Act, the board encourages the practice of providing opportunities for students to take part in religious exercises and/or religious instruction during the day." Now, is this practice legal in Alberta? Apparently it is. There's a Canadian precedent from the Ontario Court of Appeals in 1988 called Zeibelberg versus Sudbury, which apparently outlaws religious exercises in public schools, but this does not apply to Alberta or Saskatchewan. When the two prairie provinces entered the Confederation in 1905, the federal government allowed them to maintain the protection for school prayer established in the 1901 Northwest Territories School Ordinance. And those same protections were included in the new Constitution of 1982. In a survey of school districts in Alberta conducted by a reporter for the Edmonton paper, it was discovered that of 31 public school boards in Alberta, 6 encourage or support Christian religious exercises that could include the Lord's Prayer. 13 allow such things, but with various restrictions, such as the students can opt out if they wish. 5 overtly prohibit religious exercises in public schools, and the remaining 7, it wasn't clear.
Haven't made up their mind.
Or it just wasn't clear from their website. The other thing that I discovered is very different about Alberta when compared to the United States, or Canada in general, is that citizens can direct their tax payments to support Catholic schools. I can tell you that would be illegal in the United States, and if citizens can direct their tax payments to support Catholic schools, I ask, why can't citizens in Canada direct their tax payments to support Muslim schools or Sikh schools or Hindu schools or Jewish yeshivas? The governmental preference for Catholicism, quite frankly, seems strange to me in an increasingly diverse, religiously diverse country. So, the questions that I would put out for conversation, and there are lots, and you may want to raise some of your own. What role should religion have in public education? Is prayer appropriate in school settings? For example, graduation ceremonies, football games, whatever the case may be. I know there's a lot of praying that goes on in school. Dear God, help me pass this test. but is organized prayer appropriate in school settings? How should religious holidays be treated in public school classrooms? Should secular symbols associated with religious holidays, such as Christmas trees, be allowed in schools? Do our answers to these questions all depend on the age of the children? Maybe we feel one way about elementary school students, a different way about high school or university students. Is governmental favoritism to Catholic schools appropriate? Is religion necessary to teach young people proper values? And if you were in St. Albert, what would you be asking the school board to do? Just this morning, only because my wife reads the newspaper early in the morning, did I discover an article in today's paper about St. Albert. It says, trustees revise rules for prayer in schools. But the new school board policy is simply to make decisions on a case-by-case basis. So it's not at all clear what that means and where they're headed in St. Albert. Meanwhile, also today in the newspaper is a story about a controversy in Ottawa. I imagine these appear every year around Christmas time, where the school has replaced the Christmas show with a holiday craft night in order to move the school's concert outside the holiday season in order to be respectful to many other religious groups who have objected to the Christian nature of the annual choral concert in the public school. So, I look forward to our conversation. I gather we have a good 45 minutes or so, David.
That's great.
And an opportunity to engage with all of you.
Could I just ask, for the sake of clarification, how would you understand the situation that you lived through if, in fact, there was a move towards, I guess, what I would call a kind of deep pluralism in the school in Indiana? If, in fact, they did invite the Jodo Shinshu Buddhists to distribute the Tripitaka, the Muslims to distribute the Quran, the Sikhs, the Guru Granth. I mean, how would that influence the case?
First of all, we're talking about 10-year-olds. I imagine it would get incredibly confusing. I have no problem with the teaching of comparative religion in schools, with teaching about the role of religion across history, the role of religion in society, the ways in which religion informs other aspects of culture. Those are all appropriate things in the schools. I think it's government lending its support for proselytizing that is problematic.
For the confessional
nature. And it's problematic regardless of the number of faiths it's supporting. And I imagine, as in St. Albert, the atheists and agnostics would have reasons to object.
Mm-hmm. I think my understanding of the St. Albert is that the public school was...
it was a Catholic school.
The majority of the people was Catholic, and there is a Protestant separate system.
This is a historical
because of the
curiosity.
Yeah, because we're entitled to separate schools, but only divided Roman Catholic and Protestant. Mm-hmm. If the Protestants are in the minority, they're entitled to their own separate school, which is what happened in St. Albert. So the public school basically is Catholic.
Well, now you have many students who are neither Catholic nor Protestant.
Yeah, I know. So they can go wherever they want, in a sense.
And
the public school actually is, in a sense, their school.
They can go wherever they want, but yeah. Tax support is only provided for those two alternatives.
John?
I have been aware over the last 25 years that many of these religious question cases that have been brought to the Supreme Court of Canada, the Supreme Court has sided on the right, on the side of freedom from religion rather than the freedom of religion. In the Canadian Constitution, as far as I'm aware, it is stated freedom of religion, but the Supreme Court has chosen to interpret those cases as freedom from religion.
Becky and I were once invited to a meeting down in San Antonio, Texas, of a group called the Freedom From Religion Foundation. They're based in Madison, Wisconsin, and after our lawsuit, they wanted to give me an award called Freethinker of the Year. Since it came with a $500 check and a free trip to San Antonio, we went down there. Becky came away calling the assortment of atheists, agnostics, unbelievers, and secular humanists in the room the Church of the Unchurched. They were quite religious about their lack of religion.
Just to pursue that a touch, because it touches on this whole question of the role of religion in public education and the Supreme Court cases. I mean, it's one thing to frame it the way you did, John, and it's easy to see it this way, but let me just push back a little bit on it. A number of these cases are associated with either private companies where the people who own those companies have particular kinds of values, they would say, which means they are not going to do certain things, even though they're offering a public service. So there's the issue of the private company or corporation engaged in public service of some sort or another, and then refusing to serve all of the public. The other ones are where you have agencies which fly a religious flag of some sort or another, like the large Ontario Social Service Agency, which make use of a substantial amount of public money. That is, 90% of their funding is public funding. But the flag they carry is a religious flag. Catholic Social Services would be another very good example. And so is the Catholic School Board, a very good example. You're using tax money with a religious flag to provide a service which is a public service. And then you are layering into that a set of judgments about who can be employed, usually is the issue, be employed by that company. So that's not quite the same as freedom from religion. It is a little more complicated than that, I think, in a number of these cases.
We spent 10 years in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, and in both Oman and the United Arab Emirates, which are legally, officially Muslim countries, the Sultan of Oman and also the Sheikh of the United Arab Emirates said it's extremely important that all people that live there, Muslim or not, have religion. And so they donated the so-congregated land for a Christian community to build a church. And in the UAE, the Sheikh donated the bells to the church, because they wanted to make sure, even though it was illegal for a Muslim to change religion, for people that weren't Muslims to have religion and have access to religious ceremony and services. And so there was a case where a legally Muslim country was encouraging religious of other religions, even though it was not required. And it was also interesting in the malls in both countries. At Christmas time was the most decorated in an official Muslim country.
But Jesus is a Jewish or is a Muslim prophet as well. So, I mean, they celebrate the birth of Jesus. Although for us to see that, or for Christians to see that, it has other kinds of resonance, I suppose.
Christian carols that they sang.
Of about the incarnate. They didn't come up with Muslim carols.
I gather what they're celebrating is consumerism.
Yeah. Angels we have heard on high saying to go out and buy.
I've really wondered for a long time how long it would take before we had this kind of discussion in our community, in our province, and I've certainly been following the St. Albert stuff as much as I can. And when we started this conversation back in the fall, there was some discussion here about the shift from multicultural society to a plural society, and I think that was really interesting, and I'd like to see that pushed more. But pushing back a bit on what you've said this morning, on what you've presented, Alan, reminds me of being in Moscow doing a job for the Academy of Sciences back about in the early 90s, when a member of one of the professors of the Institute kind of grabbed me and walked me back to my hotel so she could talk to me about the dilemma they faced. And she really implored me, because she said, they were just beginning the change, but we have a situation here where we have to have one set of values for our children and our family inside the house. Inside the house, we operate according to this, and it may include a belief system. But she was troubled because she said, how do we move through the change as we have to have our children have a totally different set of values when they go out the door of the house? And I don't know, in a pluralistic society, just how to balance the complications of moving within our political context and our governance context and constitution in Canada, becoming more pluralistic, and then looking elsewhere where perhaps people are trying to go the other direction.
Well, that's why I asked, is religion necessary to teach young people proper values? Or the values necessary for democratic citizenship in a plural society?
We haven't had the conversation very much, have we? Because it's kind of assumed, I think, in Camrose, and probably many of us who grew up here, our parents were involved in unions. We can look around the room and see a few that were. And where, I know my parents didn't push Bible or Gideon, but somehow it was part of the social thing to be involved with that Gideon business as a social thing. And I don't have children, so I don't know how much pressure that brought on children or teachers in the school. And I think it's just annoying from you, Brian, what the Gideons are saying by way of this issue. I don't even know if they're still involved in the Emeralds.
Yeah, there is a camp. I have not had direct conversation with any members recently about this situation to know if they are patiently waiting or if they are engaged in the conversation. I'm not sure. I would be interested to ask Dr. Berger, at the time that your children were in the fifth grade, was the practice of the people who brought the New Testaments in to actually ask the students to sign their name and date it?
Yeah.
That part, that was regularly done. I remember in this.
I was never present. It's only reported to me.
Okay. I remember the distribution that took place in my own experience, that it was explained but never expected. This is what this is about. But
yeah. Well, my argument would be, adults appear to be authority, whether it's explained or expected, adults appear to be authority figures. This has the imprimatur of authority figures in the school. As the teachers stand by, the principal stands by. Clearly, this is being advocated and endorsed by the school administration.
Just to maybe sharpen the fundamental question that's been raised here, which has to do with the formation of children and how that works. I remember a few years ago, it's a number of years ago now, having the opportunity to spend a couple hours with Chaim Potok, the wonderful novelist. and we were talking about the formation of our children, and Potok said to me that he had moved from New York to Israel because a major reason was he wanted his children to go to a school, a public school, in which the biblical text had a presence, which it did in the public schools in Israel. And he wanted that because his view was that children need that in their formation. Now, he said that the teachers in Israel, he described them as fundamentalists in the public school system, probably not unlike some schools here where you would get the same kind of orientation. But his comment was, that was fine, because when they would come home, I could clean all that up. I could clean all that up around the dinner table. But at the same time, I thought it was interesting, at the same time, he wanted some kind of affirmation of the significance of those texts, the significance of those narratives, and then do the work associated with that. So one of the things that I think is so curious about the debate or lack of it here in Western Canada, Jane, is that there's this failure to bring any precision to the issue. One is Gideon's giving the Bible out. Another is Christmas carols being sung in the concert. Another is so-called Christian symbols in this context. Another is devotion. What is really, where's the place of devotion in this? And the other is the much more, I think, much more substantive issue, which is what have we done with the curriculum since 1950? And the place of serious consideration of in courses which touch on history and culture, of serious consideration of the place of religion in the unfolding and development of those things. We collapse them into each other and do that in a way which means, I think, in the curriculum, largely have stripped out of the curriculum the substantive role, for better and for worse, that religious dimensions of culture have played within history and culture. And to my mind, doing that in a deeply pluralistic way would be an enormous public service. Mm-hmm. Because it would mean, just to illustrate in a simple way, it would mean that children in Muslim families would have more to work with, and children in non-Muslim families would have more to work with in the face of what is unfolded geopolitically and which shapes the common images of Islam in our world. That's a civil failure in my view.
David, I just kind of follow up that what you said about children. Dr. Berger, I'd be really interested to know how this affected your own children in their development, and how they were they treated differently in school because of this controversy?
It's a very good question. As I said, I think the person who bore the biggest brunt was my wife, because she was teaching for the public schools. Many parents said, I don't want my son or daughter in that godless burger woman's classroom, not realizing that Becky was probably the most religious member of the family. The children, for the most part, were regarded as unwitting victims of their evil father. And so, there's a lot that can be said about the closed-mindedness of small communities, but there's also a lot that can be said about the good hearts of people who live in small rural communities. And our kids were not victimized as a result of this. I think they were aware that their friends' parents were sometimes saying nasty things about their dad, but I think they escaped relatively unscathed. On the other hand, I think this lawsuit had an important impact on their civic formation. giving them a sense of empowerment, giving them a sense that they could make a difference in society. And in many ways, it turned them both into activists. And that has continued to be an important part of their lives as young adults.
How old would they be now?
Late 20s, early 30s.
Milton?
I found it very helpful to hear your talk about your experience in the United States. And having grown up in British Columbia, you know, it sort of helped denaturalize what goes on in Alberta, because I wasn't raised with separate, I mean, if there were separate school boards, parents were paying in the Catholic system all the money, and so it was private education. And so with the constitutional guarantees that are in provinces, such as in Alberta and Saskatchewan, you know, we sort of have the vestiges of one of the colonial powers, you know, French and Catholic, and it's sort of seen, I think, within Canada as sort of a cultural element of safeguarding minority culture. But Alberta has also taken it a step farther in that even within our Battle River School District, there are charter schools, and we have a Christian charter school. So rather than sort of engaging in public discourse about different religions, we have, you know, Christian charter schools. I think we also in Edmonton have Muslim charter schools. And
which are confessional. And have a right to be confessional.
That's
under
right.
The law.
But you touched upon the fact that, including Augustana, used to receive private funding, and yet public funding from the government, and yet was considered private, and yet in terms of legal issues that came up over the years, including the fact that gays and lesbians could be fired, there's a problem because public funds are being used for private education. And that continues to this day with Kings and Concordia, etc. So Alberta is very complex because it has a number of anomalies. And, you know, even our children grew up saying the Lord's Prayer, all of this stuff here. And yet, for people, you know, many people here were not raised in Alberta. And at some level, we know that it isn't the norm across Canada necessarily. But, you know, we do have these public, two forms of public institutions educating, and they're both public, even if it's a Catholic system. And so that's just to say, it's intriguing, you know, to hear sort of our experience denaturalized a little bit from an American perspective.
I think there was a question back there.
This is coming to my mind. My daughter was driving out in a new subdivision, and 95% of her students are seeking okay. So this is the new way, and I feel like we're in a bubble here because it's a non-issue.
You mean it's more homogeneous on the Christian side here? So then do you want to translate to this issue and the way in which it has been here, do you want to translate that into your daughter's school and reflect on what it might mean for Sikh and Hindu prayers to be said? Well, they may be passing out the Rig Veda. So how would that sit for you, just out of curiosity?
You know, I went to a...
What do you think?
Well, I think that the substantive parts of this issue, to my mind, have been colonized by what I view as a kind of artificial debate, which is the debate about devotion in schools. I think devotion in schools is very much a secondary issue, to give it any weight at all, compared to the issue of the nature of that education and how it takes history and culture seriously and the religious dimensions of that. I think that's far more substantive. Furthermore, I think that there's a long tragedy around state-sponsored religion. It's, from a Christian perspective, in terms of Christian history, it's an enormous tragedy to the church's capacity to anchor itself in the gifts of the gospel. And instead of doing that, it gets colonized by the gifts of state power. So, I mean, I stand in that part of this kind of debate. But at the same time, I think the issue of restoring, I would argue it as restoring, the enormous contribution of the religious dimensions of human culture to the development of civilization and culture that desperately needs to be done in our curriculum, and it desperately needs to be done in a broad and pluralistic way. It's my argument in any case. But what do you think?
Well, I was going to mention to you that as a child, I went to a public school. It had substantial numbers of Catholics, substantial numbers of Protestants, and substantial numbers of Jewish students. And I would argue I was better off for that religious diversity, and so were my classmates. My parents thought my religious formation was important, and so twice a week, on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I boarded a train and I went to Hebrew school after the end of the public school day. And the absence of devotional activities or religious instruction in the public schools did not inhibit my parents in providing for me a religious education or my Protestant and Catholic classmates. Why does the public school classroom need to be the setting where this instruction is located? There are ample opportunities to do it outside of the public school day, and if we segregate our public schools by religion, with the Catholic kids going to Catholic versions, and the Sikh kids going to Sikh versions, and the Muslim kids going to Muslim versions, as David has pointed out, the civic consequences are potentially frightening.
The other thing that strikes me about, you know, and I read the same piece with the principal of the school in St. Albert. As a Christian, I'm outraged by what he said. And I'm outraged by what he said because what he's doing is he's reducing the devotional element to a kind of glibness that is awful.
Government-sponsored Christianity is watered-down Christianity.
It's unbelievable glibness.
I'm thinking about, and you brought it up again, the segregation of all the different kinds, as well as the public debate goes on about the Lord's Prayer and the Gideon Testament. What's happening in Alberta is Ellen Rich is the charter schools. And what we are seeing is parents choosing, saying, if I can't have that kind of a context in the public system, then we'll make our own school. And what's happening with those schools is that they are now getting public support. And so very unlike your United States experience, we've not only got government support for the public system and the separate Catholic system, but we've got government support for, you made the list.
And as I point,
Muslim and some of it is not even religious, but it's ethnic, and say we will now have Ukrainian schools and we will have Chinese schools.
So, and that
is quietly and gently segregating our society, right, while many people are wishing that our society would move to a more pluralistic context.
And the difference then between the Canadian and the American context is the belief in religious voluntarism that undergirds the First Amendment to the Constitution. And religious voluntarism, you'll recall I said, is simply the notion that the advancement of a religious sect should come from the voluntary efforts of its members, not from the efforts of government. And so the courts have been very clear in the United States that it is not only not government's role to support particular religions, it's not government's role to support religion at all. Religion has an important place in society, but not as a government-sponsored endeavor.
But here the Christian schools in the beginning were 100% supported by the families who chose to go there.
Right.
Now they're not anymore.
And we have charter schools in the States. like that, but they're not government supported.
Yeah, but they are here. And what does that mean for you?
Well, I think part of that is reaction, right? When you feel that the school also has an agenda, which is secularism or consumerism or whatever, right? And they say, we don't want, you know, as initially the immigrant group said, well, we came to Canada because we don't want to teach war, so you could create your own community, you had your promise that way. Now people from various religious backgrounds feel, well, we're getting an anti-religious, you know, secularism as an ideology, sort of as the worldview that they're supposed to grow up in, that's sort of the substitute religion kind of, and so they're reacting against that. So we have, you know, the private school, I mean, the homeschooling movement is very, very strong in Alberta, then, and plus now the proliferation of charter schools, who's saying, well, we don't find, you know, our history, our background, our religion validated in the schools in any shape or form, so let's get our own, and of course, if you do it, then we should do it, and then the government has been funding, of course, you know, a variety of goals, I mean, everything from the homeschooling to the charter schools.
So, Dietmar, you're suggesting that part of this movement is simply on the level of reaction, the level of not seeing your culture, your religion sort of validated or something in that context. So that raises a kind of strategic question about what ought to be done in connection with that, even in public schools. Huh? Milt?
We had an interesting situation a year or so ago with a teacher on the board.
Can you speak a little louder, Milt?
And that was a principal down east saw some of his students who belonged to a religious group had to sit while the national anthem was sung at the beginning of the school. And he didn't want his students ostracized. And he said, it's not a requirement to sing the national anthem at the beginning of the school day, so let's can it. And he got a horrible reaction from the community to the point where he had to quit teaching because he was psychologically affected so much by this. People were saying he was not patriotic and whatnot. But here was a small group of religious students, and his concern was that these kids were being singled out and ostracized by other kids who could stand for him. So here was a religious group dictating against a civic policy.
So they were Jehovah's Witnesses, I assume, or Seventh-day Adventists. And have that kind of teaching. As you may know, in the public school systems in Edmonton, the major pushback coming for any school taking note of Christmas, carol singing and what they do in terms of their concerts being having any Christian content, the major pushback for that is Jehovah's Witnesses. And people that would define themselves as secular humanists. They get together on this matter.
Politics make strange bedfellows.
Politics make strange bedfellows, yeah.
I'll try to make all my points quick. given the state that you now see that Alberta is different, that we in fact don't have security of position, you know, both of you are affected directly in your jobs. I assume you have either great courage to risk your jobs or some faith in your state to recognize that if you were fired, you'd have some backing against that. Which, as Milton said, we don't have that insurance in Alberta. We've worked very hard to get some of that insurance. And that was the state here in with Augustana, too, I will point out. So given that, I'd like some comment on that. And also, I really admire all the courage that you did to stand up and put your family at risk and your jobs and your lives for a point that a principal, which took great cost out of your personal life. I see other principles, it's kind of like what's practical. Gay marriage comes to mind. Women's right to choose comes to mind. And when you know, how do you choose which pillar to stand on, I guess, would be the other question. And the other influences that I see in schools that are far, well, I guess there's the comment of, I think, parents who think, oh, yes, let's have the Lord's Prayer, because they're not actually doing what our parents did, making the extra effort to bring their religious education to the kids. Parents, generally, in my sense, are kind of abdicating their educative role of their children. They're kind of thinking, we'll let the schools do that. Let's let them do more and more and more. And teachers are feeling that burden. And the fourth item I want to say, I think that the worst influence that's happened right now in schools is the consumption. That in my day, when I started teaching, we couldn't have Coca-Cola logos or all the other things. It had to be a free choice. And now the directive of how basically we indoctrinate our children in a streamline of branding. And in some ways, religion is becoming another brand. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what your comments are.
You've raised a whole lot of points. with regard to the hero thing, you know, I'm not sure if there's anything we did that was particularly heroic. I had a friend who said, "Oh my gosh, they're making a hero out of him, and he's just a rabble rouser." You know? he said it a little more colorfully. the job security is an interesting one, and an aspect that I don't feel fully informed about in Alberta.
You're secure. Don't worry.
My wife and I were both protected by a great institution.
Can you speak a little bit louder?
My wife and I were both protected by a great institution called tenure. I had tenure as a faculty member at the college where I was teaching, and my wife had tenure as a public school teacher. That meant that it would have been well nigh impossible for us to lose our jobs for our engagement in controversial civic activities. But one thing I must tell you that disappointed me throughout this entire 4-year period was the relative silence of my employer, the local Catholic college. Now, mind you, these were King James Bibles. These weren't Catholic Bibles that were being distributed in the public schools. And many of the advocates of the policy were, as I quoted earlier, quite critical of the Catholic Church. So one would think that my Catholic colleagues would have been at least quiet allies. There were very, very few. And that's something to this day I don't fully understand. But I felt at the time, and really still do, there was a thorough lack of understanding and a lack of courage among my colleagues in higher education. And that was very disappointing.
Did your courageous Presbyterian pastor suffer as a result of this in his local congregation?
Not in the local congregation. In fact, the local Presbyterian congregation was where I got more support than any place else. There was not a local synagogue, by the way, and that's why I wasn't. There wasn't a synagogue for 100 kilometers, and that's why I, you know, gravitated with Becky to the Presbyterian Church. Our kids went to Sunday school there, etc. But we celebrated Jewish holidays, Christian holidays.
They had a minion as well. So.
I don't think he suffered within the church itself. Certainly, he was ostracized within the ministerial community. He and his wife left the community several years later, but I'm not sure that it was narrowly related to these events.
Could I just make
a brief
point? Our constitutional context, of course, is different from the American context. We don't have a disestablishment clause as such, but we do, have in the Charter of Rights, which was brought in 1982, the concept of freedom of religion. And that, of course, has been interpreted. I wish our son Alex was here because he understands this better than I do. He's made some study of it. But as I understand it, we have to, of course, take into account the historical context, which, as you pointed out, at the time of Confederation and later when Alberta and Saskatchewan became provinces, there were strong guarantees of religious and linguistic freedom for the Catholic minority, primarily
French Catholic minority.
French Catholic. So that is what, that's the historical context, and that was very important at the time because that resulted in the voluntary association in a federation of two quite different elements. So I personally value that historical context because it shows that there is an accommodation for rights of minorities, which is really what we're talking about here. Much of what I hear was of the objections to your position on the part of, shall we say, dominant culture, is that we are the majority, we want to do this, why are you so upset about it? Because isn't this a democracy and we're the majority? But that's the whole point, isn't it? That constitutions and bills of rights protect minorities, and that's the whole point. And that's why we have to be so careful to make sure that there is a clear separation, in my view, even though I'm not from the American context, but just in principle, there should, in my mind, be a clear separation of church and state. Because we have seen, Jane mentioned the Soviet Union, and there are lots of examples in the world, that the coercive power of the state to promote and proselytize a particular brand of religion is so dangerous and so corrosive, I think, to civic life. But on the other hand, I also want to say that there is, as David strongly argues, there is an important value in the study and the richness of a cultural tradition, including a religious tradition, that should be given place and should be studied. So there's always a tension, and there's always an accommodation which needs to be dealt with, both in the public and in governments and school boards. And it's not always easy, and there are not sometimes no simple answers. But what I like about, I'm in the Alberta context, and what I like about this context is that there is room for debate. There is room to explore the issues, and we do have a legal system. We do have opportunities for public input. We don't always get it right, but a lot of times there is a feeling that we do need to accommodate different perspectives and different points of view, and I think that's to be celebrated.
And a big one now, of course, I mean a major player in this, I don't know how familiar you would be with this, Alan, but a major new wrinkle in all this is the First Peoples communities. Mm-hmm. Because in Canada, or at least in this part of the world, my sense is, in most schools that I'm familiar with, the only people that get paid to pray are Native elders, who are brought in under special arrangements with government money, and they're paid to pray. This also occurs in our own university. So, and the reason for this is this interesting combination of a recognition of what has happened historically vis-a-vis Native culture in this community, and also an argument, a kind of interesting argument, about the need for there to be a public recognition of, it's usually flagged as the spirituality of Native and local knowledge in this world. So that's a new kind of wrinkle that we face, and I know certainly around the issue of the discussion around Sharia law in Ontario, trying to get some public recognition of Sharia law, major issue was the Muslim communities that wanted to promote that, or the people within them that wanted to promote that idea. I mean, they had recognized that there were sentencing circles that were native. So if, in fact, the law can accommodate that, why can't they accommodate Sharia as well? So we're interested. We're heading into a very demanding matter in our charming country, which never beheaded the king, unlike your country, which cleans certain things up at least a little bit. Although I had a professor of history that I studied with who always said that one of the charming things about the United States is that we have the doctrine of separation, but in fact, our president is really a pope in a Brooks Brothers suit. Executive power, ritual power are married in that person, and you don't dress him up in drag, and as a result, people aren't quite sure what he is.
In that vein, Alex spoke of his son Alec, Valerie's son Alec, and he recently gave a lecture at Augustana on the limits to tolerance. Is there a limit to tolerance? Are there some things we just will not allow as a majority community? Well, it's coming to the schools, whether the students should be allowed to wear the sword of the or the Islamics of the kanjar, which are symbols in their own country, in their own religion, but have been disallowed in schools because of the possibility of being weapons.
Well, the banning of veils in France is perhaps the most interesting
and Quebec.
Controversial. Yeah.
But that's because they're a little bit edgy about their own Catholic past when the nuns wore veils and wimples and had all that power. So they're a little edgy. They're a little sensitive.
So the question is there a limit to tolerance?
Sure. Well, it's a huge matter in a number of these areas. So thank you so much, Alan.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted you all came. Thank you.